Okay, hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Innovations in Education, eCampus News' podcast on the latest and greatest happenings in higher ed tech this month. I'm Kevin Hogan, and I'm glad you found us. This month, we look at what a few years ago might have felt like a fad, but is now, in fact, a full-on phenomenon on college campuses across the country and the world. Esports has quickly accelerated to become a must-have at most schools. To help me break down the state of play in higher ed and esports is Victor Gomez. He's the esports manager at Seton Hall University. Victor has been instrumental in the founding, creation, and growth of Seton Hall's esports program. He's an accomplished alumnus of Seton Hall, and he has been at the forefront of the esport endeavors there since 2013, the same year that the United States officially recognized esports players as professional athletes. His expertise in the field has been integral to the program and its continued success. Victor currently also serves as an adjunct professor in the Stillman School of Business and on the Electronic Gaming Federation's Collegiate Division Board of Governors, where he leads their impact committee. It's a great conversation that Victor and I had, and have a listen and enjoy. Okay, Victor, thanks so much for joining me today. Really appreciate it. I can't wait to dig into some of the insights that you have for us regarding esports.
Thank you very much for having me.
I guess to start off the conversation, I first have to offer some congratulations. From what I read in the sports pages or the esports pages, you have Seton Hall as Big East champions of League of Legends. Is that it?
Rocket League this semester.
Oh, Rocket League. I'm sorry. Yeah. You had two teams that were participating in the Big East Conference, I guess, right? I guess start off, tell us what that experience is all about. When I think about the Big East, I think about Syracuse basketball and Seton Hall beating my Temple Owls about 15 years ago, which I'm still a little sore about. But is the esports, is it an equivalent? Give us the tourney breakdown.
Sure. So we signed up Big East schools to compete in two titles in the Big East Conference, rather Big East esports. So it would be League of Legends and Rocket League are the two main titles, though many other schools do have various titles. And in equivalency to traditional sport, there are, I would say, what are powerhouse programs and growing programs. The top three that come to mind, selfishly us, Butler University and DePaul University. And Butler in particular recently built a $1 million esports arena over in Indianapolis. And that's where we had our Big East playoffs this year.
Very cool. I mean, so that's some serious bucks. I mean, it's not the University of Texas football program yet, but that's still when you're reaching seven figures. Really interesting that feels in some senses to be a recent phenomenon, but it really isn't. I mean, you've been working on this several years now. I mean, even before the pandemic. Kind of give us a taste of where you see the space being right now.
Sure. A lot of things have changed since then. I'm actually now also an adjunct professor here at our Stillman School of Business, where I teach introductions to esports. So it's a very pertinent question. Esports as a form of competition has been around for right about 40 years now. 1972 would have been the first esports tournament, actually at Stanford, the Stanford Rocket Lab. But in terms of maturing as people know it today, live streaming and giant tournaments, that's about a decade old. Early 2000s, early 2010s. Today, I see esports is maturing. It's growing through its growth spurt from 100% really passionate gamers and creators creating something to now creating the business of esports. How do you make it profitable long term, and how do you make a real big business out of it rather than just getting the passionate players and having them do what they like, and which is competing? And so that's really the transition point we're reaching now. The United States, pre-pandemic, we were looking at reaching 1 billion market share for esports. Now, post-pandemic, we're at 1.44 billion, now slated to reach 2.5, 2.6 billion in the next 5 years. So it's really a huge market, and we've seen winners and losers in that sense. FaZe Clan comes to mind, right? FaZe is known by everyone, even if they don't know what esports is, because they saw Snoop Dogg sign on with them. And they would have seen just last month Snoop Dogg rescind his contract with them. So obviously, this is the next evolution of esports, I would say, where it turns from a small business into this mega multinational business kind of venture, if we're using that idiom.
Yeah. So when it comes to higher ed specifically, in your experience, how have esports programs impacted the overall campus culture and kind of student engagement at Seton Hall?
Sure. So really, when you're talking about higher education, you're looking for engagement as a tool to retention, right? Because the formula really is engagement, retention, successful graduation, successful alumni, and then it all restarts. For us, that was the reason behind us creating our esports lab, which as we speak is about 10 feet away from me and completely full with gamers. And we have it open from 9 a.m. to about 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and about 9:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Sundays. And we're a small campus here at City Hall, about 10,000 people, undergraduate and graduate. And we've seen about 1,000 unique users come by to that lab. So 10% of our population has used that lab for an average of 1.3 hours each, right? So we're seeing usage of 13,000 to 14,000 hours ever since that lab opened. In terms of competition, our players are top 32 in North America for Rocket League for the past 5 seasons. So that's about a year and a half. 4 Big East titles brought back, 1 national title brought back, and about 4 invitational titles also brought back to the university. So it's gotten to the point where we're meme worthy. Over the weekend where we won the Big East playoff, all of our social media, the meme pages made by students just to complain about things or unite over silly things, made one post where it was like the winning Big East teams looking at all the other teams, and they had esports there, they had men's golf there. So it was a kind of nice chuckle, but it's showing of how penetrative the esports culture shift has been, right? Whereas
Yeah.
pre-pandemic, no one knew that we existed. Now we're having meme pages talk about us and students going, oh my God, you have to come to Seton Hall this weekend. We can game in the lab, right? And that's really where things have started to change.
Very cool. Now, I know one of the things when you talk about in-person sporting events and teams and cultures, there's this idea that, behind the game itself, students are learning various skills and are acquiring certain opportunities and certain behaviors that are going to help them excel once they leave college and go off into the real world. What kind of skills and opportunities are students gaining from participating in esports at the university level?
Sure. So I'll give you an example of one of our recent young alumni. Dan, he came to us knowing nothing about esports. He wanted to get involved somehow. And we put him as the team manager for our Rocket League team. So in that meant juggling the schedules of about 6 students across 2 years and 8 tournaments and 2 leagues. During that time, he took his job very seriously. Learn tools for analysis and giving feedback to the players. Well, when it came time for job search and he got an offer for interview at IBM, he mentioned that he's a gamer. Immediately, that was a, all right, let's sit down, let's talk, let's have an interview. And so as a part of his interview process, he had to present some data that he had been working with. And so he just took his data that he learned and used here at Seton Hall Rocket League. And that was able to prove not only his skill set, but a live actual use case for that data and ways of presenting that data that could be useful to someone who isn't necessarily data centric, right? Dan now has a job at IBM. He's been working there for the better part of the last year or so. So that's one methodology, right? Where you can take raw skills like data acquisition and data analysis and transition it over. More soft skills are examples like Anthony Rossi, aka Tone. He's the team captain for our Rocket League team. He's graduating this semester. And really what he learned was dealing with players, right? He's been the captain for 3 out of the 4 years he's been here. He was a freshman when he first came in and had 2 seniors alongside him. So he had to learn how to manage not only up, but now manage teams. And how do you come back from losses? How do you keep yourself ahead when you're winning? So he took those skills, very easily transferred them, and now he has a job secured for his graduation, right? And he could pull a lot of his experiences, such as challenges that he met, problems he had to face, mediation between team members, all of that can come through esports, right? In the same way that in a traditional sports team, if you're a team captain, these are roles that are assigned to you a little bit because you're there, much more so than any coach or director could ever dream to be.
Yeah. Now, you guys obviously are quite far along this path in terms of creating these programs and expanding them and at the top of the rankings, right? Is actually as an aside, is there like a top 20 ranking that goes on?
There is many. So part of the thing about collegiate esports is that it's very fragmented, and there are many who are seeking to try and bridge that gap. So rankings go dependent on game, league, and then everything else. So
Okay.
for us, CRL is the national league for Rocket League. It oversees all collegiate Rocket League, actually globally. So we can confidently say we're top 32 because we beat out other teams to qualify to be part of CRL, which only accepts the top 32 teams, 60 teams from the West, 16 teams from the East, and some teams from Europe, Mexico, and Canada. But Mexico and Canada are counted into those 16 teams. So when you're looking for those slots, like for example, qualifying this last time, there was about 1,100 other teams competing for the same slots. So that's why it's a point of pride for us to say we're top 32.
Absolutely.
For League of Legends, after you make it out of your conference championships, and if you make it into your nationals, then you're looking at, again, top 32. And that's when you can confidently say you're up there, right?
Yeah.
In different leagues, however, that changes. So I may say I'm number one in NACE, which is a conglomerate of about 500 schools, I believe now, at the collegiate level, or number one in EGFC, which is a conglomerate of about 127 schools.
Okay. So if you are an administrator in a school that maybe doesn't have a program yet, or maybe say has a fledgling program, and in I guess it sounds like, what was a fad is now a phenomenon in terms of you're talking about thousands of schools that are participating in one way or the other. What sort of advice would you give to executives or, professionals at a university who want to take it to the next level to get to where you are?
Sure. So I'll give some advice to someone who's just starting out and someone who's a bit more into it. Just starting out, I would say listen to your students and get your data right. We at the Big East compete in Rocket League and Super Smash Brothers. That doesn't Rocket League and League of Legends start. We have Super Smash Brothers at Seton Hall just because we heard our community and they wanted a team. But a lot of other schools compete in a lot of other titles. And it could be that you set up 50 gaming machines because you want players to play League of Legends, Rocket League, and Valorant. And then all of a sudden you figure out that they only play Super Smash Brothers, right? And then you just invested all this money for no reason. If you build it, they will come, does come to mind, but you need to let them know that you're building it in order for them to come at all. So communication is very, very important. Learning your data is very, very important. And for a more developed team, you already know you have esports, you want to get to that next level. Start thinking about what you would need in a traditional sense, right? What makes a traditional sport team succeed? Well, they have rigor, academic rigor that they have to follow, schedules that they have to follow, and a place that they can go to, right? You wouldn't expect the baseball team to be competitive if they don't have a place to practice the game of baseball. In the same way, you can't expect an esports team to be competitive if they don't have a place to practice as a team. Yes, they may have all their own computers. Yes, they can play from home, but it's a completely different dynamic when someone's playing from home, right, in their pajamas than it is they're in one place, they're going through what they're supposed to be doing, and they're all in their uniforms, right? So providing that structure, that support system is really what it takes to start considering that next level.
Gotcha. Now, when you look at the horizon, the next 3 to 5 years, you've gone through some pretty crazy times the past 3 years, obviously. Assuming now that we're out of the pandemic and going forward, what does your crystal ball tell you in terms of the growth? It sounds like it's almost exponential in terms of the popularity of it. Where do you see it going in the next 3 to 5 years?
I think if we follow this trajectory, what will ultimately happen is the same thing that happens in traditional sport, right? Where you're going to have your powerhouse schools, the schools that are known for what they do, and schools that are known for niche things. So one beautiful part about esports is that it's an industry, right? It's not just competition. So, for example, Boise State is a powerhouse school, both in gameplay, but the real gem is their broadcast, right? They put these amazing, amazing broadcast productions, and that's run by students, right? On the flip side, you have someone like Northwood University who doesn't have the stars and lights of Boise, but they will absolutely bring the competition, right? For a game like Rocket League as an example. And then you have Fisher College, who does kind of both, has great competition, has great broadcast. So for us as Eaton Hall, we have that great competition. We're looking to fill in that next void, right? That great content creation and teaching our students those skills. I'm going to assume a lot more institutions are going to get into teaching esports and refining what that means. You don't teach the MBA, you teach sports management. Right. In the same way, esports is in some ways similar and in some ways very different. And that's what merits it separation. But the skills that you need are very similar, right? You're still managing people, you're still managing some sort of competition, and you're still running a business at the end of the day. So we ourselves, I started teaching Introduction to Esports. We're offering a 3-credit version of that class in the fall of this year. And that's the first step to hopefully a certificate. So I'm predicting a lot of schools will go that route as well in order to also prepare their students not only with soft skills, but hard quantitative and qualitative skills as well.
Now, how about it, while you keep looking in that crystal ball, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges putting these programs together and some of the challenges that the space overall might meet going forward?
I think the biggest challenge, like every other new endeavor, would be financial, right? Until esports becomes so normalized that everyone has a budget number for it, it's going to be a hard battle to gain financial acuity, I would say. As an example, if esports were to rest in the Department of Athletics, there all the problems would be solved, right? You have staffing, you have the support system, you have years of paperwork that tell you what exactly you should do with a student competing, travel, all those things. But the unique challenge of that is athletics has to deal with both Title IX and with amateurism. In collegiate esports, it's filled with professional players or semi-professional players. And if you were to give a student the chance to earn money, earn sponsorships, earn partnerships, and make a career, or go to college and pay $250,000 for an education or whatever it is that your tuition is for the 4 years, I would wager someone would choose making $250,000 in a year potentially over putting in $250,000, right? Higher education as a whole has changed, and the pandemic has forced us and students to reevaluate the position of higher education in the world. So if you now challenge someone to give up the rest of their career or come and play in collegiate, that's a potential pain point, right? So athletics, for the most part, in a lot of campuses is approaching it with trepidation, right? NIL has passed, so that's made things a bit easier, but amateurism is still a big wall. Title IX in particular is something that is hotly debated from, I don't know why Title IX needs to be in this conversation too. There's no reason why Title IX should not be, right? There's a whole range. Most recently, one university in Florida, I will say to be safe, had a spat in the court because they claimed they were Title IX compliant when taking into account their esports numbers. And so they caught an athletic program while counting those esports numbers.
Right.
Well, a judge ruled against that because they weren't receiving the same support as other sports, right? So they weren't receiving all the other bells and whistles that an athletic team would, so they shouldn't count as a sport. And so that the sport that was cut was to be reinstated within a year and for that institution to come back into compliance with Title IX. Moreover, that judge ruled that esports shouldn't fall under Title IX at all. So as we move forward, there's going to be a lot more challenges to that, right? As leagues become more structured and as universities come to grips with where it should land, I definitely feel like Title IX is going to be a part of that conversation. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But that would be the second most, I would say, not pain point, but rather things that we still need to flesh out as an industry.
Yeah, well, it just sounds like those are the costs of popularity and success, right? And some would say good problems to have. Well, listen, Victor, thank you so much for your time and your insights today. It's really an exciting and a terrific topic to talk about. I mean, it seems that the students are excited about it, and you can see how it reflects overall in the in society, how esports has become this massive, massive thing, and it's a lot of fun to follow. And I appreciate you helping us through the process.
Yeah, of course. My pleasure.
Good luck to the Pirates in the Big East Conference next year.
Thank you very much.
So that about wraps it up for this episode. Be sure to check back on ecampusnews.com for all the latest and greatest news and analysis for what's happening in the higher ed tech space. Remember, eCampus is always free and always helping innovative educators just like you. Until next time, I'm Kevin Hogan for eCampus News.